The DigitalLifestyle.com presents The Media Centre Show, show 167, Thursday, 31st of July, 2008. With Ben Automation. I'm Ian Dixon, and this week we're going to be talking to Ben Drawbar, editor of Engadget HD, and we're going to be talking about extenders, plugins, home automation, security systems, and a whole range of media center topics. The Engadget HD blog is a great place to read about HD topics and includes a lot of media center content, so it's great to talk to Ben. I also have your email and a roundup of the news items from the blog. So welcome to the show, it's great to have you along. Going to dive straight into the email. As ever, you can email me, Ian, at thedigitallifestyle.com. I do like getting new emails and reading those out. And also, if there's any of the topics that you hear in the show and you want to comment on, you can drop me an email. So it's Ian at thedigitallifestyle.com. I'm going to go to the first email, and this week it's from Martin. Hello. I was wondering if you had a way of converting FLAC and WAV files to Windows lossless. This will enable me to play quality audio via Windows Media and subsequently through my Media Center extenders. Regards, Martin. Thanks for the email, Martin. I did have a quick look around and I did find some utilities on the FLAC source code page, which is flac.sourceforge.net/download.html. And there's a link for that in the show notes. And there's a few applications it mentions for converting, and one of those is MediaMonkey. And I know MediaMonkey is an application we've talked about on the show in the past, so it's definitely worth looking at. And converting those over to lossless WMA should mean you'll be able to play those on the extenders. And of course you can rip them as well. You can rip directly into WMA lossless. It's just a setting in Windows Media Player. So thanks for that email. And now I've got an email from Chris. It says, hi, this is Chris from Indianapolis, Indiana. I've been using Media Center in my living room for quite some time now, and it's become my primary means of consuming media content. My friends are always asking me how I set my system up, and many of them are beginning to try Media Centers themselves. Thanks in part to your show, I'm on the leading edge of technology and can share your advice with my friends. Your tip on activating DVD Gallery with a simple register edit was a wonderful find. Thanks for all the work, Chris. Thanks for the email, Chris. It's great to see that you're leading the way and showing people Media Center. And hello to Indianapolis. As you may know, I'm a big motorsports fan, and obviously Indianapolis is a place that one day I'd like to go and see the Indy 500. I've done the Formula One and Le Mans, so the Indy 500 is one of the places I want to go to see. It's great that you're leading the way with Media Center. It's a shame that Media Center doesn't get more marketing, and people don't realise that these features are available, and it is one of those things you've got to see. So it's great that you're leading the way. If you've got any thoughts or stories you want to tell me about and how you've been convincing other people about Media Center, the email address for the show is ian@thedigitallifestyle.com. Please keep those coming in. I do like getting them. Okay, so let's have a quick roundup of some of the news items off the blog this week. And you may remember the Samsung Media Center extender I saw at CES, and there's a video that I did of it, which is a link for that's in the show note. Well, they finally released it, and it's now changed its name from the Digital Media Adapter to Media Live. So the product's called the Samsung Media Live Extender. This is the extender for Media Center that's designed for the 2008 model Samsung HD TVs and uses HDMI CEC to control the extender from the normal TV remote control. So you may remember it from back at CES. Basically, this unit can fit behind the TV, and the TV's remote control can control the extender by sending the control signals down the HDMI cable, so you don't have to have extra cables, or you don't have to have the remote in line of sight because it sends them around through the cable. So it looks an interesting Media Center extender if you've got a compatible TV. Because according to the press release on eHome Upgrade, the unit was available for $200, which is a pretty nice price if you've already got one of these TVs. Obviously, if you've not, then you're going to have to look at one of the other types of Linksys and HPs and the D-Links. It's nice to see another extender on the market. I've had quite a few comments on the blog asking if it was available in the UK, but I haven't had no information on that yet, so I'm pretty sure they said it's at CES it was US only. And talking of extenders, you may remember me getting a bit upset by Paul Thurrott's dismissal of the new generation of extenders on the Windows Weekly podcast with Leo Laporte. Basically, he said that the extenders are no better than the old models and they were not worth looking at, and he totally dismissed them. And I disagreed with that at the time. And I guess Paul may be looking at softening his stance on them. He's done a review of the HP Linksys and D-Link extenders, and he definitely seemed to like the HP extender the most, which is not that surprising given that it's the most expensive and I would kind of describe as a premium extender. I think he needs to have a look at the Linksys extenders again. As a commenter on the blog post that I did said about he should really have a look at these things again because the firmware has changed since he first looked at them. But I was happy with the Linksys ones. I have no issues with it when I was using it. I'd still be using it if it hadn't been had to go back. So I think the new generation of extenders are working really well for me anyway. I've got the HP one on loan now and that's working great. I've been happy with both Linksys ones and I'm also using the Xbox 360 as well. So I'll include a link for that in the show notes. Last week I finally got my hands on one of the HP new TouchSmarts, the IQ500. Ever since I first saw this back at HP's event in Berlin, I wanted to get hold of one. I got the review unit and I must admit we're really loving it. I recorded an initial unboxing and first impressions video which I've posted up on thedislifestyle.com. And there's a link for that in the show notes. I've since now got it in the living room and I'm actually using it as my main media center system. It's not connected to my TV, but it's got my it's where the tuners are in, and I'm using it via the extenders, the HP and the Xbox extender. So I've got that in my living room and my kids love it. I was looking the other day, watching them playing out the other day, and there's some drawing applications that they're really liking, but they're even touching up photos with the photo editing software. So they had pictures of themselves and the friends that I'd taken, and they were doing the red eye reduction. And they're only six, but they could use the touch interface with no problem. And it's really nice to have a machine that you can kind of sit down at and look at RSS feeds and look at some news headlines and perhaps put some music on without having to pick up a keyboard or mouse. It's very inviting, and it's one of the first devices that I brought home that my wife's really said, can we keep this one? Unfortunately, we can't, but I am seriously considering purchasing one. As I mentioned on the show in the past, I've been looking at replacing my media center box and going for, a Tower One, and or maybe one of the new Dell ones that are on the blog this week, the nice little units. But I think one of these would be nice to have in the room somewhere for pictures and everything else, and it plays video and it's a really nice unit. So check out the video that's in the show notes. I'm going to try and record another video to show the UI off a bit better. Now I'm working on a series of how-to articles that will either be blog posts, part of the Media Center show, or videos. So I wanted to get your feedback on what subjects were worth tackling. I asked on Twitter and got some questions, suggestions, including DVD streaming and QAM support for Media Center, and there's some comments on the blog post as well. So what how-to topics would you like to see covered, and not just for you guys, the enthusiasts, the experts, but also for new people coming into Media Center? Is it how to get your build your music collection up, how to stream recorded TV to extenders, things that a new person coming to the Media Center ecosystem would like to see? So you can let me know, ian@thedigitallifestyle.com, or with a link to the post in the show notes, you can leave a comment on there. And I'm going to start planning those over the next few months and start producing some of those. And finally, I want to mention about Windows Home Server and the update talked about on last week's show. You may have seen reports that the new HP update is actually slowing down the MIDI Smart HP Home Server. And you can see David's post on the Windows Home Server blog on thedislifestyle.com for the effects on that. But Brian Birch, Director of Marketing for HP Connected Entertainment, has provided me with an official statement regarding the issue and really how to avoid it. It's best to read the full post for details, but I'll read a quote for one paragraph that I thought might be interesting. He says, and he says the McAfee Total Protection Service must index all the files stored on the server in order to provide prevention against virus attack. The Packet Video PV Connect will, upon installation, create a database of all the media files, such as photos, music, and videos on the server. When these two services are installed together, the combined first run indexing by McAfee and the data creation by Packet Video can use the majority of the resources on the server. This may result in slow response times from the server until those activities have been completed. If the user has also installed other add-ons or software packages on the server, then there may be an additional lag in the response time. It also has been reported that the Windows Home Server console may become unresponsive at this time. As a result, we recommend that users install each update one at a time. Well, like I said, the link for the full post is in the show notes. But it makes sense, really. The McAfee has to index the whole system, and the Packet Video does the same thing, so you can enable those ones one at a time. I've enabled the Packet Video, I've not enabled the McAfee, and I've had no issues at all. So it's good to know that that HP are listening to the feedback from the community and the blog, and letting us know the issues. So you can find all the topics talked about on today's show on the podcast blog, which you'll find on the digitallifestyle.com. You'll also find on my blog there, the Windows Home Server blog, the Gadget blog. There's a lot of great stuff on there now. You can follow me on Twitter, which is twitter.com/isdixon. Most of the frequent updates go on there. So now we're going to talk to Ben Drawbar from Engadget HD. Ben, welcome to the Media Center show.
Thanks for having me.
And it's really good to be talking to you tonight because you're from Engadget HD, and I've been reading that blog for ages. I noticed you switched a while ago to Media Center, to Windows Media Center. So I thought we could talk about what was the reason behind that switch to Media Center, and how have you found using the system over your previous devices?
Well, yeah, I did switch recently, and mainly I had been wanting to switch ever since Vista came out. I used to play with the old Media Center, the version right before that, 2005.
Yeah, 2005.
And I was always interested in the cable car tuners, but TiVo managed to come out before Vista Media Center with cable car devices. So I had a couple TiVo Series 3s, and once I made that investment, it was even harder for me to consider Vista Media Center. But one of the things I always had a hard time managing was the multiple rooms, and I have a centralized home automation system. And I really wanted a way that I could have the same content in every room in my house without having to manage which source was going to which TV. So before, I had a matrix switch, which had 8 inputs and 3 outputs, and I could funnel any one of the inputs to any one of my outputs, which works great. But the downside is that, you know, if I'm on input 1, you know, it could be of a concern if someone else is in another room trying to watch that same source. You know, you can
right.
almost, you're seeing what they're watching. So it was less than ideal. And then on top of that, when you'd record something on one TiVo, you can't just watch it on the other TiVo. You have to actually transfer it before you can watch it. And you can start to transfer at least, but you end up with two now playing lists and 2 recorded TV schedules. And it's not very centralized at all. And if you needed to record on 3 tuners at once, you had to manually go to the other one and schedule it. It wasn't smart enough to say, oh, you have another tuner in the other room, do you want to use that one? So with the recent extenders that have hit the market, and the cable car tuners finally reaching a reasonable price, I think I paid $1,200 for a Dell XPS with a cable car tuner, quad core, 3 gigs of RAM, shipped to my house. And based on what I'd previously invested in TiVo, if you consider how much I had in service, I actually spent less on my Vista Media Center with extenders and a Blu-ray player than I did on 2 Series 3s with 3 years of service.
And I guess then, of course, once you switched over onto a PC platform, it opens it up so you can do so much more. You know, you've got software add-ins, and you can take content out and stream stuff, and it opens the whole world of possibilities up.
It really does. You know, you can play content on there without having to pre-convert it, because you can just by installing an additional codec, and and the user interface is very modern compared to TiVo, which has gotten very dated. One of the things actually that's been kind of killing me is the ability to keep changing it. Like, I have a hard time not fidgeting. And sometimes you can start tweaking the system, and your wife is not very happy because you got the system down. And she just wants to watch TV, and hey, honey, I'm installing the latest plugin. Doesn't really go over very well.
I guess you get the same thing as me then, because all the extenders, as I've been trying those out, and I've even tried out a few, all-in-one remotes, and my wife's like, "Which remote are we using tonight then? You changed it
Yeah,
again."
exactly. Which remote
So,
are you using right now? I'm just curious.
well, actually, using the I had an all-in-one remote, and I'm just currently trying to put the HP MediaSmart Connect through its places. So I'm using the MediaSmart Connect's remote, which is which is you can program as well, which is quite nice. But I must admit, I end up going back to the Xbox controller. I don't know why. When I'm using the Xbox as an extender, the Xbox controller is actually pretty good for controlling Media Center, and you don't have to be in line of sight either.
Yeah, I really liked the Xbox Media Center remote that it came with, especially for $20. My only gripe was that it didn't have a recorded TV button. It had a live, I guess, had a live TV button and a guide button, but not a recorded TV. Or maybe I got that backwards. But I know what you mean about the controller. It is kind of nice to have the wireless. I'm currently using one of those Philips remotes. It's rebranded under Origin, something I can't remember. It's a nice skinny Media Center remote. It's one of the newer designs. And I've also been trying a Harmony One lately, but I really, the Harmony just doesn't set well with me. It's too easy to program, I say.
Right.
It's so easy, but you can't do exactly what you want because
Yeah.
they make it so easy.
Right, yeah. To simplify it, you can't get this kind of the flexibility you need.
Exactly. So that's one of the I've tried a few Harmonies. I have the Harmony One right now, but it'll be going up on eBay here pretty soon. I think I'll go back to the Media Center, a regular Media Center remote.
Yeah, well, I've tried the Media Center remote, which I quite liked. I've been using the All for One all-in-one remote, which you can program and it can from codes and it can learn, which is quite nice. And you can set the like there's a home theater mode on it, so you can set the volume controls to control your receiver. You can set the transport controls to control the Xbox. So you kind of got this one remote doing multiple functions without having to switch, which is quite nice.
That is pretty nice. The way I get around that is by leveraging my home automation system. So I have a Media Center remote or whatever remote really, and in my home automation system, I can program infrared commands to do any function that I want. So I'll take the, for example, the power button that comes on the Media Center remote, and I'll go into Media Center and tell it not to respond to the power button. Then I go into my home automation controller and I teach it that code. And then I tell it that whenever it sees that code, it's supposed to turn my entire home theater system on and off based on the current state it's in. So I turn it into a toggle. And the toggle toggles like two macros. So for example, it will via RS-232 send a command to my TV. It will send a command to my audio video receiver. It will send a command to my matrix switch, which I still have, all via RS-232. And then using a really great plugin called VMC Controller that I got off CodePlex, I'm able to send TCP commands, kind of like the Autonomic Home that you guys talked about a few weeks ago. It's kind of like their plugin, except this one's open source and it's not, there's no charge. It's free to use. It doesn't have the nifty client side software though, so it's kind of just for it's for people that already have automation controllers, not necessarily someone who's looking for a way to control it with a Nokia or something. So anyway, so I can send commands, and I actually, with some help from Charlie Owen recently, I was able to modify the VMC controller plugin so that I could add an additional command that wasn't supported. I had to learn a little bit of .NET, but he helped me out, and the author of VMC controller helped me out, and I was able to add monitor off. And the reason why I needed that, I don't know if you've ever run into that. Do you use HDMI with HDCP at all?
At the moment, I'm only just started really because I'm using HDMI with the MediaSmart Connect, but I normally use a VGA cable for the Xbox 360.
Well, when I first ordered my Dell, I didn't really pay much attention to the video card, and I made the mistake of ordering one that doesn't have component output, which I didn't even realize they still made. And it wasn't until later that I realized that my only options were a VGA and HDMI. Now, all my equipment is centralized, so my TV's in the other room. So in order for me to switch to VGA, for example, I'd have to run another 35-foot cable. And I already have component and HDMI sent over there.
Right.
So I've had to use HDMI as a result. But the problem is that when I was finding that when I turned my TV off, the HDCP was still trying to handshake. And it was causing errors when I would come back and try to turn my TV on and the screen would be black. And I would have to, like, close Media Center, which, by the way, was not easy when you can't see the screen. In order to get it to come back. So by adding this functionality to where I could actually turn the display off, or at least make Windows think it was off, I was able to get it to not try to handshake. So my automation controller will go through and it knows the state that every device needs to be in, and then conversely, when I go to turn the device on, it'll bring me to live TV, because when I turn my TV on, that's where, you know, that's where I like it to be, right at live TV, so that I can see what's on. Sometimes I just turn the TV on for background noise, and I just like to have it on something, you know?
Mm. So some interesting points you raised there. So first go back to that HDMI problem, because I'm sure I've had listeners email in about that as an issue before. So just explain what that issue is, where the TV doesn't appear to come back on when you go back from Media Center.
Well, HDMI, it can be protected, and most TVs or displays that have HDMI support HDCP, which is just the control protocol, the content control, the DRM, you know, to put it nicely. Mm-hmm. And there's a handshake that goes on that basically verifies that there's no third-party device in the middle between the TV and the media center. That way you don't try to capture it if such a device existed. Well, I guess there are a few devices now that exist, but it used to be they weren't. Anyway, so you couldn't grab one of these HDMI capture devices and capture the output. So if the handshake isn't successful, the output of the display is actually disabled and the screen goes completely black. So what I would find is when I turned my TV on, my screen would just be black. And at first, the only way I could get it back would be to hard restart the Windows box. And because I didn't have Vista Media Center, I have regular Vista Premium, not Ultimate. I can't remote desktop into it. So what I found is that if I enable the Telnet server, which is a security risk if your machine's on the internet, but mine's, you know, I have mine all locked down because I don't use it to browse. So I have Telnet on. I would Telnet in, and I would actually use Taskkill to kill EH shell. And that would bring me back to my desktop, restore the display, and then I could restart again. So my initial fix without programming was to just tell the display to turn off after 15 minutes of not being used. Even though the computer really can't turn off the display, because the computer believed the display was off, it would stop trying to handshake.
Right. So you wouldn't get that issue.
Right.
On,
the problem with that is that the 15-minute counter starts from the last time you press a button, not from the last time video was playing. So what would happen is, if I was watching a movie and the movie would end and the done, restart, delete screen would come up, the display would immediately go black. And my wife would say, "Ben, the TV is broken." Of course, pressing a button would make it turn back on. But, you know, it's annoying to say the least. Mm. So by adding a way to where I can remotely turn the display off, or at least make the display think it's off, I've prevented that. So it worked out as a pretty good solution. And I was actually kind of fun learning a little bit of .NET, because it really blew me away how unique it was to other programming languages that I've played with.
It's just interesting you mentioned that, because I know plenty of people have come across that HDMI issue, and I never really found a good solution for it, so that's an interesting way around it.
I have heard that it is a known issue and that it is on the list of things to be fixed in future releases, but I think the real fix is going to be, I believe, my understanding is that they're going to make it so that if you set it to turn off the display in 15 minutes, that counter will start when the video stops. And that's the fix. Because really, you kind of want your display to turn off automatically anyway, to prevent like burn-in and let's, you know, to save your TV and things of that nature. The other thing that would be nice is if Vista Media Center supported HDMI CEC, because then you could send a message to the TV to turn off over the HDMI cable, and the TV would actually turn off.
That would
be nice, which is much easier than running an additional cable. What I have is I have a Cat5 cable running from my home automation controller to my TV, and then I have these very inexpensive, they're like $1 each, they're RS-232 to DB9 adapters. And you buy them and you have to pin them yourself, which isn't that hard because you only really need 3 of the 9 pins. And then it basically gives you up to like 150-foot serial cable. Now, unfortunately, most TVs don't have RS-232 ports, but a lot of them do. And if you have one, you can actually pretty easily tell your TV to turn on and off and things of like that. Even if you don't have a home automation controller, you can do it right from the Vista Media Center. But with M-Control, it makes it so easy because you can pick up M-Control for like, what is it, $100. And it has a really great RS-232 driver plug-in architecture. And literally, if you know a little bit of hex, and in probably about an hour, you can write yourself an RS-232 driver using M-Control. And then you can write macros that say, when Vista Media Center turns off, turn the TV off.
So for this, your TV needs to have some kind of serial interface on it.
Well, it makes it easier. The nice thing about serial is that it's two-way and it's a hard link connection. Of course, you can use an IR blaster as well to control your TV with something like Ghost Sync, or you know, also if you have, for example, if you have M-Control, it also supports things like the Global Cache, which is a network-enabled IR blaster. It also supports things like the USB UIRT, which is a very inexpensive IR receiver and transmitter that's via USB, which is a little harder to extend 50 feet, but it's still, there's a lot of different options for for actually controlling your TV. The real problem with IR is that anyone who's used a blaster knows there's a delay involved, it's not 100%, and you know, there's other issues involved with trying to use infrared, and not all TVs have discrete on and off, so you end up only being able to send a toggle command, and then, you know, if the TV's on and the computer thinks it's off, they're out of sync, and it thinks it's sending it an on command when it's really sending it an off command, you know, it just becomes, infrared can be messy. Whereas if you do a little research before you buy a TV and you get one with RS-232, then it just makes it a little easier.
Yeah. So just step back there. Just tell us about this home automation system. What you're running this on and what you're controlling?
Well, currently I'm actually using something from a company called Cinemar, and they make a product called Main Lobby. And Main Lobby's primary focus was like a DVD jukebox software. I believe that's how they got started. And what made them different from, say, most, like, say, your MyMovies plugin, is the theory was you actually wanted to have your DVD box covers in your hand. You didn't want them on the TV. So you'd have something like a Samsung Q1 or some other wired or wireless touchscreen, and you would have your DVD box art and all your selection there. And it really built into an entire home automation system, where it can control Vista Media Center, it can control really just about anything you want. Now, what I'm controlling right now is I have an Elk alarm system called the M1 Gold, and that gives me the ability to do some cool things like when the baby's sleeping, I can disable the doorbell, and when you press the doorbell button, it puts up a message on the media center saying the doorbell's ringing. Or someone opened the back door, something of that nature, so you know someone's home to go help with the groceries.
That's what's nice about having everybody up with the Big Ben chimes when your doorbell rings.
Right, exactly. So you can I have my I still like to chime, so I have an automation rule that turns the chime on and off at certain times. My daughter goes to bed at around 8, so the chime turns off at 8. She gets up around 8:30, so the chime goes off on at 8:30. You know, because I still like to chime. It's, you know, in case I'm not in front of the TV. But it's nice to have that additional connection where it brings the two together. The other thing my Elk does is it actually connects directly to my thermostat. Now, there's a lot of thermostats out there that can connect directly to the home automation controller. But it's nice to be able to have the Elk connected directly to it, because the Elk is still, let's just say I've never had to reboot the Elk. And,
right.
You know, your air conditioning, you want it to, although if the Elk completely turned off, the air conditioning would still continue to work. It's not that level of integration. It's still nice to have something as dependable as an embedded device like a security system to control your thermostat. So that enables me to turn my thermostat on and off at certain times. Like, for example, my thermostat turns on. It goes up to 85 degrees when I set the alarm armed away. No one's home, turn the AC up. When I come home, no matter what time it is, it sets the thermostat back down for me. So it enables you to do some things like that when you have your thermostat connected directly. Now, most automation controllers like M-Control and Cinemar, they'll interface with thermostats directly as well. But it's nice to have the flexibility so you can choose the way that you want to do it. But the biggest thing that I have that I really like having automated is my lighting. Now, I've been using Insteon for about 2 years. I have about half my house switches converted to Insteon. They're about $45 a switch. So unless you're, you know, pretty well-to-do, it's easier to buy 4 or 5 of them at a time rather than try to outfit your entire house at once and, you know, have to fork over $3,000 or $4,000 in one shot. So I've slowly started with my home theater room, and then I've worked my way out. Now, I've tried for years to control Insteon with M-Control, with Main Lobby, and with other devices, but Insteon, evidently their SDK, has a lot of holes in it, and I was never able to achieve the results that I felt like I was sold. You know, the feature list was never fulfilled after 2 years. And Ted over at M-Control, he was explaining to me why they don't support groups. Or scenes. Well, I suppose I should explain what that is first. A scene is, like, my favorite scene is watch a movie. When I turn on watch a movie, it turns my living room lights, which is my home theater, to about 40%. And then it turns off all the lights in the adjacent rooms, the light that would bleed into my living room, down to zero. And I can activate that with the press of one button. And conversely, I can go back to where all the lights are on with one button. And I have other scenes like garage at night that light the pathway from my detached garage into my house when it's dark out. So when my security system senses those doors are open, it activates that scene. Well, one of the problems with M-Control, Ted was explaining to me, they can't activate scenes. And since I really liked my scenes, and that's one of the main reasons why I bought it, it really, I was very bummed out because the M-Control user interface in Vista Media Center is really slick. And the other Vista Media Center integration is really great. So, you know, but the lights are like my favorite part. So I was like torn. And Ted was telling me about this new device from Universal Devices called an ISY99. And that M-Control, they had planned on supporting this device. Now, the problem with this device is it's $300. And, you know, I kind of felt like, why should I have to pay extra money to get my lights to work that I already bought? So I was very hesitant at first, but finally, after doing a little research and all the great reviews, I picked one up. And let me tell you, Ian, this thing is unbelievable. I call it the magic box now. This thing is it's basically the size of an iPod box or like a Zune box, a really little square box, smaller than a checkbook box. And all it has is 2 Cat5 ports in it. One goes to the serial adapter for the PLM for the Insteon, and the other one goes into your Ethernet. And it's actually powered off of the serial adapter. And in 2 hours, I was able to configure every single scene in my entire house that I'd never been able to configure before in 2 years.
Wow.
I mean, it really is an unbelievable device. And I tell everybody, if you're going to if you're going past the home theater, like if you're going to home theater and you're, let's say you just have a couple lamp modules and you just want to control some lamps and a couple of lights, so when you turn your when your movie starts the lights dim, you're probably okay without the ISY. But if you want to do your whole house and you want to have some pretty complex scenes, I say 10 switches or more. Then this ISY, if you think about it, 10 switches is $450. So once you get to 10 switches or more, it's really worth it to get this device. It just because it, what it does that makes it different is not only does it allow you to control your lights from your, any internet-enabled computer, because it has a web interface and a Java interface, but it actually manages your lights for you with a drag-and-drop interface to create all your scenes. And anyone who's using Insteon would not really associate the word reliable with complex scenes. And this thing, somehow or another, it actually does it. It's able to overcome the limitations in their SDK, and it's able to make the devices work the way they're supposed to work. I mean, I can't stop raving about it. It's like the best $300 I ever spent, believe it or not. M Control, Ted was just telling me their ISY plugin is expected like in a matter of days. So I can't wait to try that, and I may switch over from Cinemar's main lobby to M Control because most of the features of the Cinemar main lobby I'm not really using. And there's a couple things that main lobby can't do that that annoys me. So I'm hoping that by switching to M Control once this new adapter comes out, plus the new M panel is really, really cool as well, I'm hoping that ends up being the perfect solution for me.
So from M Control, you can control this device, which then controls all the other Insteon lights around your home. And by scenes, you mean so this is a preset thing, so you can say right, this light needs to be at 10%, this one wants to be off, this one wants to be at, you know, full brightness when I select this scene.
Right, and what's even cooler than that is not only can you create the scene, but you can actually create how long it takes for the scene to activate. So I have my movie scene take about 15 seconds. So the lights just don't, so when you're watching the movie and it's real dark in the room, the lights just don't, boom, jump on and scare you, or it doesn't just get dark all of a sudden. It's a slow, they call it a ramp rate. It slowly ramps to that level. And you can control, in the ISY, you just go in the user interface. And what's really great about it is you can open the scene and it lists all the lights in that scene, and there's sliders. One for brightness, one for ramp rate, and you literally just drag them, and that's it. And it just so you can get the scene perfect. You know, you don't have to walk around the house and hold each dimmer until you get it the right level, and then record the setting, and then enter the setting or anything. You just sit there and you drag these little sliders right on your laptop, and then there's no apply button or anything. Like once you drop the slider, boom, it just knows that's your setting. Oh, that's a little too bright. Let me turn it up a little bit more. And then even if you have 8 lights in your scene, let's say you don't want to set all 8. Let's say all 8 are going to be the same. There's like an apply to all button. So it makes the management. It really is more about management than it is about control. Because, I mean, like Insteon, M Control's had Insteon Control for years. I mean, they were one of the first to control. But they don't really let you manage your switches. But their new version that is, they actually have a new, that 2.1 that's out, due out any day now, it's supposed to let you manage it has a new Insteon little side utility that helps you manage it. I haven't tried it yet, so I'm not sure how good it is, but I did notice that was something that they were adding, like as a value added.
I mean, I guess, like you said, the on and off controller part of it is pretty straightforward, but setting all these things up, like with levels and everything else, and if it's not manageable, then it's just something you're not gonna really bother doing.
Exactly. And the other problem I had with Insteon was that once I would get my scene set perfect, a few weeks or even a month would go by, and one of the lights in the switch and of all of them would lose its memory, and it wouldn't remember that it was part of that scene, or it would turn on instead of off, or something silly like that, and with the ISY, it's actually like they expect it to happen. And when you do a backup, it actually backs up all the scene settings and all the device settings in your entire lighting network. And that at any time, you can walk up to a device or into the user interface and you can right-click on it and say restore. And it'll actually restore every single setting in that individual device. Because what's cool about the Insteon scenes is you can set up a scene to where, let's say you had one room and you only had one switch going in. When you switch that one switch on, you can set it to where that activates the scene. So instead of only activating that one switch, like it always has for years, it actually activates like six lights in your room.
Because really, when you think about it, the lights aren't really... I mean, it's like an old way of thinking, isn't it? One switch, one light. It is about
right.
scenes. It's about brightness levels. It's nothing to do with a physical switch connected to a light bulb.
Exactly. And the... So when you come in you hit that one switch and you want that scene to go on, what's great about the ISY is even if the ISY lost power, it's actually the nature of Insteon, I should say, those light switches know what scene they're in. So even if your entire home automation system is down, all your scenes still work. Because the light switches know, oh, I'm in that scene, that's my group. They know to turn on at that point. So it's really robust in that nature, especially when you can repair. There's also a repair feature. So let's say the switch goes completely bad. You can actually go in there and it will replace. There's a repair feature in the ISY that says replace the switch. And you put in the switch's MAC address and it will. They don't call it a MAC address. I can't remember. They call it a hardware address or something. But it's like a MAC address except it's only three octets. And you put that in, and it'll actually go through the network and fix the whole network. So no matter how many scenes that one switch is in, it'll fix all the other switches in your network so that that switch behaves just like the old switch that was there. The ISY actually has a very good web SDK that's a web service. So it makes it very easy for other providers to develop drivers to work. In fact, I think Ted over at M-Control told me they got the latest SDK on Wednesday of last week, and they expect to have a beta driver out in 10 days. That's pretty fast for dev time. Most of the other drivers I've seen in development are more like 90 days. So it's pretty amazing that it's that easy to develop for. One of my only griefs, other gripes about M-Control, and I've expressed this to Ted, is the inability to customize the user interface. You can add your devices and everything. It makes it really easy to add all your devices in a list. I mean, you can be set up in minutes, but you know, if you really don't like the look of it per se, and you want to change this, that, or the other, I really don't feel like it's that customizable, especially once you get beyond the Vista Media Center interface. Like, for example, although I love Vista Media Center, I'm all Mac home, and I can't use the M-Control web interface because the Mac or their IE interface for M-Control only works in IE. Mm. It doesn't work in Firefox or Camino or Safari or anything. So it kind of really limits my exposure. And I really wish there was something a little bit, a better solution out there. I've been helping these guys over this new project called Open Remote. And they're taking a more open community approach to home automation. But they're very, very much so in the discovery process and the learning and the sitting back, and they're almost they're still trying to figure out exactly what their project's going to be. But I really like that approach because I'd really like something. I like something powerful out of the box that you can set up in minutes, but I like to be able to take it further if I want to. You know, if I want to dev into the code, and I'm not a developer, but I can hack someone else's code. You know, if I see what's on there and I get in there and I can modify it enough to understand what's going on. And I like to have that ability. And most of the home automation controllers out there, including M-Control and Main Lobby, they're very closed, and they keep... Like, I contacted the Main Lobby people about developing a plugin for the ISY, and they basically told me they didn't want there to be one, so they wouldn't give me the SDK.
Right.
I mean, that's a very closed approach.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why I don't really want to work with them anymore. Even though I have, I think, about $300 or $400 invested in their software between all the different plugins that I have. So, you know, it's you really kind of kind of got to really consider what home automation controller you want to use. Because once you go down that path, all that development and configuration time, you almost don't want to go back down it again.
Yeah, definitely. Switching platforms is not just the physical, you know, the time. It's not the devices. It's the effort that you put into configuring the whole thing and getting all your scenes and everything else going.
Especially with some of the systems that are out there where they're very specific about what they support. You know, if you're looking at a home automation controller, you definitely have to spend some time looking about how they support, like for example, the M-Control, how you can write your own RS-232 drivers and you can teach all your own IR commands. Some systems aren't like that. And if you wanted to support, you know, a Pioneer Curo RS-232 interface, you have to wait for them to develop the plugin. You know, they don't have an architecture that's set up to where you can just figure out what hex strings need to be sent to the device and write your own little plugin. So it's, you know, it's luckily a lot of them do. You know, the Crestrons and the AMXs of the world, what's the other media center-centric one? The Exception Innovation. Most of them have a pretty open architecture, at least from the RS-232 standpoint, if not from the user interface standpoint.
So you're controlling your lighting, you're controlling your TV and your receiver and your media center, and you mentioned about security cameras. You've got those connected up too?
No, you know, that's one thing I've wanted to do is security cameras. I've wanted to do that for a long time, and it's never gotten to the top of my priority list. I would love to have one as a baby cam. You know, my wife is the protective mother type. And, you know, I swear she just gets up and goes in the other room just so she can look at my daughter to make sure that she hasn't, you know, passed away in the last 15 minutes. And it would be great if I could give her some sort of way to just bring up that camera on the TV, which M-Control makes pretty easy, as well as a few other options out there. So that's one thing I would really like to do. The other thing is I would love to have my living room is all the way in the back of my house. So, you know, sometimes I don't want to go up to the front door to answer it for Jehovah's Witnesses. So it would be nice to be able to see if they're who's at the door before I walk like all the way across the house. So I'd like to have a front door camera as well, but I haven't went down that path.
And I think I remember seeing at CS some of the Linksys IP ones, and they integrated pretty well into M-Control.
Yeah, they have a hardware list up on their site, and they're adding different ones all the time. I mean, most of them that have a web interface will work with most of them, most of the different home automation controllers out there. So it's definitely worth your time to look and see which cameras, especially if you already have a camera. Or in my case, you know, I want a camera, but I don't want to spend a lot on a camera. I mean, to me, it's a nice thing to have, but it's not something I'd want to spend $300 or $400 on one of them. So I would make sure that when I do go down that path, I'm going to look and see what the best bang for the buck is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't want to spend, you know, you want to make sure that, I mean, it's great if there's a Panasonic one out there that's $600 and has tilt and pan and built-in Wi-Fi and everything else. But, you know, I wouldn't mind just having a nice wired one that, you know, maybe is only $125, you know, that works just as well, even if I can't tilt and pan it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're just using, you know, if it's pointed at your front door and you're just using it for check who's there, or if there is somebody there, you know, and you, like you said, you don't really need a great, you just want something that works. So it is worth always checking out these things. It's not always the most expensive is the best option.
Right. But, you know, the other thing that I control, I really like having my home theater control. It lets me do some other really cool stuff, like, you know, in my bedroom, I have my media center extender connected to my Sharp television, and I have a media center remote. Now, one thing that's always bothered me about any programmable remote I've ever had, other than like your all-in-one Harmonies that have, you know, that do almost anything, is there's never a sleep button that's programmable on the remote, right? So you always have to keep the other remote nearby so that you can just hit that one button to put the sleep timer on before you doze off. So with the home automation controller, I'll program one of the buttons on the bottom of the media center remote that I don't use on the extender to activate the sleep button in my home automation controller. So it'll
right.
see that and knows that's the sleep command. So it lets me get beyond the IR remote. and lets you do other things. And the other thing I have, I use it as an alarm clock. So Monday through Friday at 6:30, when it's time to get up, the TV turns on to my favorite news channel. So using VMC controller, it turns it to live TV on channel 8. So I can watch Today in high def, and it turns on my Sharp television and turns the volume level to a nice level, one that's not gonna, you know, blow me out of bed, but at the same time I can't really sleep through.
Yeah.
So it you can do some cool stuff like that as well once you start to integrate everything in your house together.
And that's where this kind of the smart thing comes in, isn't it? You're not just switching devices on and off through a TV interface. You're actually, these things have got some intelligence, so they do things that you want it to do, like wake you up or go to sleep or whatever you want.
Right. And some people get even a little bit more advanced when they do things like that, to where, you know, when you, for example, if you turn your TV off after 11 p.m., and the lights are dimmed and the alarm is armed away, turn the hallway light to 15%, turn the living room light off, turn the kitchen light to 10% for 15 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, you can really think about, when you're walking through the house to go to bed at night, which switches are you turning on and off, and which ones do you wish were on so that you could see? And really, you can make the entire process, and these rules end up usually take me like a week to do, because I'll come up with the idea, I'll read it on a forum somewhere, I'll hear it on podcast, I'll try to like to make it work for my own home, and you know, inevitably I'm that's a little too bright, that shouldn't stay on that long, things of that nature. And there's a lot of them that kind of annoy you, like my dishwasher. The thing's very noisy, so I don't like to listen to it, so I like to turn on before I go to bed. Man, would I love for there to be a way to where when I turn my sleep timer on my TV that my dishwasher starts. That would be fantastic if I could do that. But there are some things, like, you know, I haven't seen a dishwasher with RS-232 or IP control yet. So
no.
Yeah. There are some limitations.
Yeah, it's not there yet. But then you can kind of see this in the future. I mean, we were talking to Ted on the previous show about you know, things like utility companies putting sort of home automation or sensors on their, so the meters for the water, electricity, so that through home automation software you can see how much electricity you're using. So if that stuff kind of comes in, that you can see, you know, in the future where we can link these devices together that way.
All right, you can use it to save power. One of the things I'm trying to figure out how to do is tell how long my air conditioning is actually running for. Mm-hmm. Because I turn it up during the day, but I really don't have any kind of concept of how much money I'm saving. So I would love for there to be a way, and unfortunately my thermostat doesn't report that status. So I've been looking at other current monitors and other things of that nature to tell. The other thing I'd like to do that I see in my future is irrigation control. Insteon makes an irrigation controller, and there's a few others out there, and I would like to be able to control that through a web interface and check the status, rather than having to go out to the garage and click next, click a wheel around in circles. You know what I mean? It just seems like it would be nice if that was something else that was tied into the entire system. Mm-hmm. So the other thing I've seen that's pretty slick is some people, they'll actually install additional thermostats into their house. And they'll program them. So let's say maybe you have a guest room, and when your mother-in-law comes, she complains because you keep the thermostat too cold. Well, you can – I think that happens to me anyway. You can actually put a thermostat into another room, or even just a temperature sensor, not even a thermostat per se. And then you can – people have retrofitted. You can buy them professionally, but you can also make your own air vents that you can open and close with a servo. And you can actually separately control the temperature in just one room. So if no one's staying in your guest room right now, the cold air doesn't blow in that room at all. And if someone is standing there that likes it hot or cold, you can, obviously you can't make it colder than the rest of the house, but you can always make it warmer, or I guess if it's in the winter, the opposite. So there's a lot of different options out there, and there's a lot of real fun do-it-yourself kind of hack-type projects where you can learn a little bit about electrical current and servos and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, I've seen some pretty interesting do-it-yourself drape kits that'll open and close your drapes for you. There's also some very nice, you know, professional ones. But you really, the sky's the limit. I mean, your imagination, for the most part, limits what you're able to do if you're not scared of a multimeter and a soldering iron.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Yeah, if you just dive in there, then there's a lot you can do.
Of course, that would require me to watch less high definition TV, which would be a problem.
Yeah, and speaking of that as well, from reading the blog, you did an interesting comparison of the extenders. So just tell us about that. Which extenders did you get to test?
I got to play with an older 360, which, believe it or not, I don't own a 360. I got to play with the D-Link, the 750, and the Linksys 2100. And, you know, all of them were very enjoyable to use. Ultimately, I liked the Linksys the best. If you're not considering gaming, you know, once you bring gaming into it, then it's very hard to argue with the 360. But if you don't game, which I don't, I bought a 360 when they first came out because I wanted one. It was great to have it, and I looked at it, sat on my shelf for a year, and I never played it. And I ultimately sold it to buy some other gadget. And that's why I don't own one. And I thought about picking one up again as an extender, because, you know, every once in a while I would like to play a game and maybe get something off the live store. But the price, once you buy the least expensive 360 in the U.S. is $280, which Microsoft does a great job of controlling that. $20 for a remote and $20 for a high-def cable. So you're basically at, you know, $340, where you can buy a Linksys for $240 on Amazon all day long. And recently I was able to pick up one on Dell for $130, which is a crazy price. So the Linksys I ultimately liked the best, mostly because of the price. But the other reason why I liked it better was because it was smaller, and I felt that it was a little more versatile than the D-Link. The user interface was identical. It had a better remote. Even though it felt cheesier, it at least had programmable power and volume buttons, which I think is important because the extenders, you can't control the volume through the extender. You have to have the TV volume, you know? So it seems silly to me that any extender would come with a remote that didn't have programmable volume buttons on it. And the other thing that I really liked about the Linksys is that I don't know what the standby power. I really wanted to do a measurement, but I still haven't. But the thing turns on in 10 seconds versus like a minute on the D-Link. And, you know, it's nice to have it turn on like automatically. Now, of course, it does this because it's really on in the background. So the standby mode probably uses more power than the D-Link, and that's probably why it turns on so much faster. But it's definitely something that I appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to wait a minute, do you? I mean, that everyone sat there looking at you as you're waiting for this thing to boot up.
Well, yeah, usually you would leave it on, you know, anyway, right?
Yeah. So,
but if you're the type that you like to turn things off because they use less power, I'm sure it still uses less power in standby mode. The other thing that's a real good reason to turn it off is because, you know, it's not using that tuner. You know, as you know, if you have 5 extenders and only 4 tuners, if you leave one on to one of the channels, you're going to get that tuner conflict message. So there are some other reasons to turn it off, or at least stop playback of the video while you're watching it. But, you know, my only gripe with the D-Link is that it doesn't have the really cool animated transitions that the 360 and the real Vista Media Center have.
I found that, but I guess once you start using it and you're watching it, you know, your content, you don't really notice it too much.
Yeah, it's eye candy. It's like, you know, most people wouldn't even notice it until you got used to one and then you switch to the other. That's when you'd notice it. You know, the D-Link does have the extra media capabilities, but there's just something that feels really, really wrong about leaving Vista Media Center to play media.
Yeah.
So I just don't, like, I don't know if I would use that. I don't know how I would explain to my wife that she has to, like, hit close and exit just to go over to this other area to find a movie that I had somehow obtained.
Yeah. Now, have you tried the HP MediaSmart Connect?
No, I really wanted to get one of those in my hand, but I didn't have one. They weren't ready in time for my review, and I have yet to see one. I guess you and Chris are are hogging them all up right now. But
Yeah.
one thing that I liked right off the bat was I really liked the remote. It seems like a really nice remote, programmable and everything.
Yeah, it is just a really nice remote, and if I got that on the video. It's a backlit remote, and you can program it for multiple devices. So you can program your TV, a DVD player, and a receiver. They can actually control about, I think, what are we? Five devices, as well as the extender, which is pretty nice.
So which ones have you had the pleasure of playing with?
The Linksys, both Linksys. The Xbox 360, which is normal my full-time device, and the HP box. So the only one that I've not played with is the D-Link unit.
From a complete, sorry to be the interviewer all of a sudden, but from a complete media center experience, which one do you like the most?
I like the 360 because the noise level hasn't been an issue, and I've got it set to boot up straight into Media Center. It does work nice. It's very responsive, but I'm actually liking the HP unit because of the HP's own software.
Really?
Yeah, and you mentioned about moving from one UI to another UI to play content. The one nice thing about the MediaSmart software is that it'll take it consolidates multiple sources. So you've got content on a MediaSmart. Also on my Windows Home server, I've got content on my laptop, I've got content on different devices, orb or whatever. All these show up together, so it's n a nice way of consolidating all the content. So it's good for music and pictures and whatever if you're just not sure which server they're on.
I see. That's yeah. That I get. I could see where that would be useful for bringing it all together as one. I guess I'm a little bit more diligent about making my bringing my content to one place because of I guess I don't because probably because I have no other choice to be honest with you. But I know exactly what you mean. You know, one of my, I was just telling Ed Bott this week via email that one of my disappointments was that Microsoft didn't give extender manufacturers as some sort of plug-in API so that you could launch their user interface directly from within Media Center without forced having to close it and then, you know, open the other UI.
Yeah, that is it. I know what you mean. Well, that's w one nice thing about the on the HP button. There's a big button that says media on it, and as soon as you hit that, it takes you straight into the HP
Now,
software.
is that actually on the Vista Media Center user interface?
No, it's on the remote. It's a big button on the
Oh,
remote.
I see. So, okay, so you don't have to. I gotcha. That
Yeah.
is nice.
Yeah, so that's nice. But still, there is this kind of, you've got two worlds. You've got the Media Center UI and you've got the HP UI. But I think it's a step in the right direction, the consolidated view. You're not pairing to, you're not stuck, for a one-to-one pairing, which you are in Media
Right.
Center.
The thing I would really like to see right now, more than anything else, is I would love to see a Blu-ray player with a Media
Yeah.
Center extender built in. I love Blu-ray, man. I've owned it for almost 2 years now. I was one of the suckers who paid $1,000 for the first Samsung player, and I haven't seen a DVD since. And I absolutely have fallen in love with movies all over again. It's very enjoyable to watch a Blu-ray movie with a scene where they're in a club with strobe lights and not to see any compression artifacts. It really was something that I didn't think I would ever see again after we switched to digital. And it's really great to have that great quality, but it's right now the way my system is set up, I'm pretty much limited to Blu-ray in my main home theater room where I have the light on home theater Blu-ray drive that I picked up for $130 from Newegg. And I was able to get the ArcSoft Total Media Theater software on sale for $40, and it has a plugin that goes directly for Media Center. So it overtakes the buttons on the remote automatically, and you have a play Blu-ray right on the main menu. And you know when you put a Blu-ray disc in, it pops up and says play DVD, which you know is insulting, but it still works. And so it really interfaces well with Media Center, and it's a really great experience. And it's funny because I actually sold my old BDP 1000 for more than I paid for my Blu-ray software and Blu-ray drive to go in my Media Center. And it's a much more capable player, and I don't have any problems with it. It's actually one of my favorite parts about my Media Center. And it would just be so great if I could actually take that into the other rooms. You know, it's just kind of disappointing that. And you know what's funny? And I'll say this out loud because I figure Hollywood, maybe they'll fix it. I'll buy a Blu-ray movie for my daughter, like Ratatouille, and then I'll go on the internet and download a digital copy of it just so I can play it on the extenders so she can actually watch it in her room.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it, that you've got to go through those, those hoops
Right.
for
Yeah,
content you
I own
have
a
to pay
copy.
for.
I just put it on top of that TV because it makes me feel better
Yeah.
to have it in that room, with the where it's being watched.
Yeah.
It's just unfortunate that the laws the way they are. But so I would really love. I'm kind of optimistic, with Samsung and their extender coming out here pretty soon.
Yeah, the little
I'm
unit.
hoping maybe, yeah, that Samsung's going to be the first major manufacturer. And I say major manufacturer, I mean like consumer electronic manufacturer. I mean, not to say HP, Linksys, and D-Link are not, but there's Samsung TVs and there's Samsung. You know what I mean? There's not. I'm sure there's HP now TVs now, but that's more of the exception than it is the rule. It's Samsung, Sony. Those are the big, Pioneer. Those are the big CE companies, right? And it's good to see one of them coming out with an extender. And Samsung was also the first to come out with a Blu-ray player. So maybe it's a little wishful thinking, but I would just love to see them come out with a Blu-ray player and extender all in one. I think that would be something that would hit home for me. And, it seems that it's like the same hardware these days, right? It's, the same codec support and codecs and UI enhancements. I mean, it seems like the hardware itself would be the same for both. I mean, even Blu-ray drives all have Ethernet ports in them now, right? So, I mean, what else do they really need in there? Maybe a little bit different remote with a green button on it, and you're pretty much set.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see that as a device of the future. Although I'm still hoping for the movie download things, but we'll see how that goes.
I really like movie downloads. Also, I have an Apple TV, and I've rented a few movies off of there. And when I used to have my 360, I rented some off of there. But and don't get me wrong, it's great for some movies, but there are some movies that. You really like No Country for Old Men. It's got this great cinematography and this great soundtrack, and you really want to hear it and see it at its fullest extent, and you don't want it to be ruined by your own obsessive compulsive disorder to notice compression. Now, if you're the type of person who doesn't notice it, then God bless you. You're great. Ignorance truly is bliss. But when you're, cursed the way I am, and your eye is drawn to any imperfection in the screen, it just makes it so much harder to enjoy, like a serious movie. That's now, if you're gonna watch like semi-pro and you're just in for a few laughs, high def's great, but I mean, you're not, you're just laughing anyway, right? You're not really gonna be taking out of the movie experience because of some compression artifact or something. So while I love downloads for the convenience and the spontaneity of it, I like discs for the ultimate quality, the no sacrifices when it comes
Absolutely.
to picture and sound.
Yeah.
So I think both the technologies will continue to coexist for many years until they figure out a way to bring one under one medium. But I think at least for the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to see physical almost become like the laser disc slash old people who like to have something in their hand that they can feel, and then downloads being people who aren't don't have obsessive compulsive disorders and they can enjoy a movie without overanalyzing it and are new age. And I think you're just going to see both paths live together, which is why a media center extender and a Blu-ray player together is the best of both worlds, especially if someone was able to bring. Speaking of which, why do you think it is that no one brings high def movie downloads to media center?
Yeah, it's frustrating, really. I think it's because everybody wants to control the environment that they go in, so you can kind of get it through the Xbox Live Marketplace or Apple control it, but it's all controlled at the end point, and I think they're trying to avoid going down the PC platform at the moment. But I guess,
I think
Cinema
you're.
Now
I think
and those kind of
yeah.
things will do it in the future, and Netflix.
Well, they. Well, Cinema Now, I believe, already has high def, but not for many of the big studios. So it's. I think I agree with what you said. I think it's about control, and I believe, and I have no proof of this. It's just an opinion that I believe that Hollywood requires the attachment to hardware, because look at Apple, who sells movies and TV shows for the iPod, but if you want high def, you're locked onto the Apple TV. But standard def you can get on the iPhone or the iPod. Vudu, another great example. Xbox Live Marketplace. All those are are controlled on that hardware, and they feel like that physical access gives them. And you know, on one hand, I understand because it's so easy to crack Blu-ray and other technology. But on the other hand, if the Blu-ray copy is out, do you really care if the Xbox Live Marketplace version's out? I mean, the Blu-ray copy is perfect. It's like a perfect master. Like, why would you care if the Xbox Live version that is still great but isn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just seems kind of silly for them. It's almost like the dam is broken. Quit trying to hold back the water.
I think it's just going to take time before we see this, before the studios, you know, get used to how we want to have the content. So, you know, the next few years, maybe we'll see a slow change, but I think it will be slow.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I have a saying, actually, and that is, we'll have digital downloads when Hollywood says we can.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not technology. It's them not wanting to give them to us.
Yeah.
So.
Now, one thing I wanted to mention as well before we finish is that your podcast. So just for anybody that's not heard it before, just tell us a briefly what that's about.
Well, you know, each week, Steve and I, we go over our favorite topics that happened in high def that week. There's actually been a lot of Media Center news on there ever since I got my my Media Center, as you can imagine. Mm. But we try to add a little bit of commentary and opinion to the news. So we find that people either love it or hate it, because if they think we're funny and they think we have good opinions and they like the show, but if they don't, then yeah, not so much. Because we're not really into delivering the news, because we figure the news was already on the blog.
Yeah.
So why are you going to listen to the show if you could have just went there and read about it in the last week? But one thing is unique that we've been doing for a couple years now that I really don't hear a lot of other people do, is that we're fortunate because people put comments on the news stories before we discuss them. We actually are able to incorporate their comments and opinions on a news story into the show. So most of the time, reader feedback and comments is from a previous show, which we do that also. But it's also cool that we're able to go in and, this news this week, here's why I think it's interesting. An old Jim from Texas, he thought it was funny because of this. Mm. And it really adds another angle to the show that that I think is a lot of fun. And, you know, we do guests from time to time, so we'll have to have you on there. Do you have a high-def TV. I saw it in your video, so that means you qualify.
Hey.
We are HD snobs, after all, over there. Yeah. We don't give a lot of... we don't give a lot of slack to those with standard def still. At this point, we figure if you're tech junkies, there's not really an excuse left not to own a high-definition television.
Absolutely not. So where's the place to go to for the podcast and the blog?
Engadgethd.com is the blog. And then on the right-hand side under our categories, there's a podcast link. And if you click on that, you can find our podcast feeds and all that stuff. We come out every Wednesday at 11 o'clock. That covers the last weeks. And then, of course, you can also find it in iTunes.
And it works for the Zune as well, because that's how I get it.
Yes, it does work for the Zune as well. Someone, one of our readers was nice enough to send me a link on how to create a Zune feed. So we added support for that. Our readers are very keen. If you notice, we offer our podcast in like 8 different formats, because whatever format you don't offer it in is the one you get all the. Why don't you have AUG? Why don't you have, you know what I mean? You get like, you're like, okay, why don't we? So, my only regret about our podcast is our regular feed doesn't. We don't have a feed of our advanced, MPEG, our advanced format podcast. And I always wish we did, because I love podcasts. You can skip past sections because some of them don't interest you. And I really love having the ability to skip past a topic that I'm maybe not interested in. And our show is very topical. We usually cover 10 to 16 topics. And let's face it, if you're not into Vista Media Center, you just want to get on to the next, you know, the new ESPN that's coming out in high def. You know, you don't really want to listen to it. So it's unfortunate that you have to download that one manually instead of through a feed. But you know, as big and, you know, the good and bad of being owned by AOL is that sometimes you don't have control over everything you do. It's not like, you know, the digital lifestyle where you're basically run the whole thing. You know, AOL pretty much runs it. I just work there.
Yeah.
And, you know, but at the same time, when I go to CES every year, paid, you know, I'm not complaining either. So, you know, you got to take the good with the bad. And the guys over at Engadget, all the different Engadget Mobile and High Def and Classic, they're the greatest bunch of people I've ever worked with. So it's definitely a great experience. Even though once I found out, you know, when I first signed on with them, they weren't owned by AOL. And when I finally got my contract, it was from AOL, and it was really very hard for me. Because I never really thought much of the company. Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to be blogging for AOL?
Yeah.
How did I get into this? So, but it's worked out great. So
well, it's been great talking to you tonight. I think we'll have to definitely get you back on again, because there's a whole area of HD TVs and stuff like that I wanted to talk about. But I think we'll cover that on another show. So many thanks for your time.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
Thanks to Ben. You can email the show in@thedigitallifestyle.com. You can follow me on Twitter, which is twitter.com/isdixon, and on friend feed, username AMD. Don't forget the blogs, the forums, everything else. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. Bye.